Well, thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very happy to be giving another talk at Perimeter. So I talked about those cross diamonds in May this year. So now I want to focus a little bit more on the quantization aspects of that. Okay. So there are many peculiarities of quantum gravity that makes it different from other field theories, such as the total absence of local observables. So gauge invariant observables cannot be localized in compact regions in the bulk of space-time. We have the famous problem of time. Time in quantum mechanics is treated as an external parameter, but in gravity, it's a dynamical aspect of the theory. And another version of this problem is that we would typically think of time as deforming the Cauchy slice. Let me laser point. Okay, as deforming the Cauchy slice, but that is usually a gauge transformation in gravity. And the very notion of the quantum space time is fuzzy. For example, you can see this by noticing that the spatial metric and extrinsic curvature, they do not commute, therefore cannot be specified simultaneously. And it's perturbatively non-renormalizable. So it's worth going beyond the realm of perturbative analysis and try to, if we're really trying to understand the nature of the space-time, it's worth going being very careful and doing things non-perturbatively. But given the lack of experimental guidance, one perspective is to push the current theoretical framework to its ultimate logical limits. Perhaps there are lessons to be learned, and it's nice to see exactly where things break. I do not think that this approach will directly lead to the fundamental theory of gravity, as I think a major conceptual revision is necessary. But I think that this may give hints towards the next step in this direction. And one thing is canonical quantization, which is a magnificent tool that has worked on many different scenarios. And I think it's worth exploring it deeper and as carefully as possible. And by canonical quantization, I mean it in the most basic sense, which is that the quantum theory is inspired by the algebraic structure of classical observables. So essentially, you have a set of classical observables, and you're trying to construct a homomorphism to a set of quantum observables in some Hilbert space. And in doing that, we want to consider the full structure of the classical phase space, in particular, all the constraints, the gauge invariance, and the topology of the phase space. And we want to have no preconceived notions about what are the states in that theory. We want to derive the Hilbert space by whatever it's necessary to carry a representation of this algebra of observables. And in particular, from this perspective, the point of view is that path integral is something to be derived from after the quantization. Okay, so in gravity, even the pre-phase space, if you are trying to, let's say, impose the constraints at the quantum level, you would start by quantizing the pre-phase space. And in gravity, even the pre-configuration space has a non-linear structure. It doesn't have the structure of a linear vector space. In particular, we would like to consider metrics that are Riemannian, or if you're thinking in the frame perspective, you want to consider frames that are non-degenerate. And that does not define a linear subspace within the linear space of symmetric tensors. Also, if you want to impose the constraints are very nonlinear. In particular, they are nonlinear in the momentum variable. And the shape of the constraint surface is certainly doesn't have a linear structure. It has some odd features as well, such as, for example, the projection to the constraint surface towards the configuration space is not surjective. There are metrics that cannot solve the constraints. You can see this, for example, in asymptotically flat space-time from the energy positivity theorem. Okay, so let me just start by reviewing the basic Dirac quantization. So that applies for phase spaces that have a linear structure. So it's from R to 2n. And there we can take global coordinates, xi and pi, satisfying the canonical commutation relations. And if we assume that they are represented self-adjointly, satisfying the usual the corresponding algebra, then from Stone-Von-Neumann theorem, we see that there's a unique unitary irreducible representation that is given by complex valued wave functions living on the configuration space, Rn, and with a measure that is the dnx. And this has the familiar form. But here we see that this is only compatible with linear phase spaces. In particular, the spectrum of the xi's and the pi's, they are the whole real line. So this is only compatible when those coordinates are global coordinates ranging from minus infinity to plus infinity. And another thing is that the uniqueness is also very special to this algebra, and that should not be taken for granted. Most algebras have non-unique irreducible representations. Okay, so that was the introduction, and now I'm going to talk about... So first, I'm going to explain this Isham group theoretic method of quantization, which is one possible way to generalize Dirac's canonical quantization. And then we're going to apply it to some very simple examples. For example, the case of a particle that lives on a sphere, a two-sphere. And there we're going to learn this interesting Casimir matching principle that is used to refine representations. Then I'm going to talk about my theory of causal diamonds in 2+1 dimensional gravity and discuss the quantization of that, and then apply the Casimir matching principle to select preferred representations. And then I will end with a simple comment on an interesting twist quantization. Okay, so the idea of Isham is that instead of thinking of the coordinates x, I, and p, I as the basis of the quantization, you think that you know that the p coordinate generate a flow that translates along the x direction, and the x coordinate generates a flow that a symplectic flow that translates along the momentum direction. So the perspective here is, and that defines a group of translations on the a group of symplectic translations on the phase space. And the idea here is that to take this group of symplectomorphisms as the foundation of the quantization. So more generally, the idea is that we should find a transitive group G of symplectic symmetries of the phase space, and then construct the quantum theory based on unitary, irreducible, projective representations of that group G. To spell out the logic, we note that each element Ci of the Lie algebra generates an infinitesimal symmetry flow on the phase space, and it's associated with a Hamiltonian charge Hi. The Poisson algebra of these charges is homomorphic to the Lie algebra of G. Actually, at this step, it may be only homomorphic up to central charges. But if we do find a central charge at this step, you can always centrally extend your group and restart the program with this extended group. And then at this stage, you will find a true homomorphism between the two algebras. So you always assume that there's no additional central charges at this step. Transitiveness, and I remind you, so a group acts transitively on a manifold. If for every 2 points on the manifold, there's at least one group element that maps 1 point to the other. And this implies that the set of charges generated in this way is complete. in the sense that any observable can be locally expressed in terms of them. So now that we have a complete set of charges that form a closed algebra realizing this symmetry of the phase space, then we can apply the basic rule of canonical quantization. And then we replace this classical algebra by a correspondent quantum algebra of self-adjoint operators acting on irreducibly on some Hilbert space. Okay, going back to gravity, as I mentioned before, the pre-phase space before imposing any constraints would be given by the cotangent bundle of the space of Riemannian metrics on the Cauchy slice. But as I mentioned, this has no linear, it doesn't have a natural linear structure. So if you take two Riemannian metrics and take a linear combination of those, the result may not be another Riemannian metric. Therefore, the standard group of translations by symmetric matrices do not act naturally on this phase space, which means that the naive quantization based on this algebra is not valid. However, the affine group does have a natural action on this phase space. And in the affine group, we transform the matrix by acting with invertible matrices, so elements of G, L, N. And then again, you translate the momenta by symmetric matrices. Now, this group, the affine group, it has been studied studied by Powder, Isham, and others. It is a transitive group of simple automorphisms on the pre-phase space. As a simple example, we can consider 1 plus 1 gravity. So in that case, by what I mean is that we have a metric on a one-dimensional manifold with a deep invariance. And the only deep invariant aspect of a metric on a line is the total length of that line. And the total length is a positive quantity. So you can think that we are quantizing the phase space that is R plus times R. Now, analogously, the affine group where you multiply the position x by a positive number lambda, and you translate p by some real number k, that acts as a transitive group of simple automorphisms on that phase space. And the flows associated by this action are generated by those two charges. So the thing that generates those rescalings of position are generated by pi, which is the product of x and p, and by x. Well, the one generating translations in p is generated by x as before. But then, okay, so then it satisfies the affine algebra. And then in the quantum theory, we want to represent the analogous algebra and therefore find a unitary representation on some Hilbert space. One finds here that the Hilbert space is given by complex valued wave functions living on the half line, only on the positive numbers, but with a modified measure given by dx over x. This has interesting consequences, such as it may change the self-adjointness, unitarity, and affect the spectrum of operators. Okay, now I want to discuss this. So Ted, my advisor, and I, as a warm-up problem, we have studied the implementation of Isham quantization on a sphere for a particle living on a two-sphere. And to make things more interesting, we consider that there is a net magnetic flux on the sphere. So the integral of B is non-zero and is given by 4 pi G. So G is the magnetic charge. But we don't want to think of this as a sphere embedded in an Euclidean space. We want to just use the intrinsic topological structure of the sphere to carry out the hypothesis without making any unnecessary assumptions. Okay, so first we know that S2, due to its topology, it admits no global coordinates. And moreover, the usual manner to treat a magnetic field is to change the to modify the Hamiltonian and change the momentum P to P minus EA, where A is the magnetic form, one form, and E is the electric charge. But you see that A is not globally defined in this case. Otherwise, the integral of dA would vanish on the whole sphere. And we know that that is non-zero. So the Hamiltonian is not globally defined, and therefore it's not an observable in the usual sense. So we can deal with the second issue by modifying the symplectic structure instead of modifying the Hamiltonian. So in this alternative perspective, alternative description, you keep the Hamiltonian equal to p square, but you change the p in the symplectic form. So the symplectic form is dp wedge dq, and you change p to p plus ea. Now you see that the first term is just again dp wedge dq, and the first term involves exterior derivative of the a one form, which is just b. So but B is globally defined. So now we have both the Hamiltonian and the symplectic structure as globally defined quantities on the phase space. Okay, but we still need to worry about the first issue. So the sphere has no global coordinate. And then we apply Eicham's quantization. So what we need to do is to construct a transitive group of symplectic homomorphisms on the phase space, which is the cotangent bundle of S2. Since S2 is a homogeneous space for SO3, it's natural to start with the action of SO3 on the sphere. That is by, of course, rotations. Now, any action on the configuration space has a natural lift to the cotangent bundle. So the points in the cotangent bundle are one forms, and so you can simply pull back by the inverse transformation. And that defines a map. This defines a transformation on the phase space. And this action is symplectic, but it's not transitive. It only acts laterally on the phase space. We need to enlarge the group by adding some sort of vertical translation. So we need something that moves points along the fibers. So I will go into some detail here because in this case it's more intuitive to understand. And everything will apply very naturally again when we discuss causal diamonds. So one way to define those, so for given any one form field W on the configuration space, that defines a momentum translation, right? So you simply take P, the one form P, and subtract the one form W. So that defines a transformation on along the fibers of the cotangent bundle. And this is a symplectic homomorphism, provided that this one form is closed. However, this is an infinite dimensional group of momentum translations, and that is unnecessarily large for our purposes. We just want to construct a minimal group of symplectic transformations that act transitively on the phase space. And there's a natural prescription to find this to find a smaller set, which is the following. We need to find a linear representation of K. So K is the group acting on the configuration space. So we need to find a linear representation of K on a vector space V, such that at least one orbit in V is homeomorphic to the configuration space Q. So in this way, you can think of the configuration space as embedded into this vector space V. And therefore, any element W of the dual of V defines a one-form field on Q. And you can use those one-forms to define the momentum translation. And that defines a transitive action together with the K action before. Okay, so then possible canonical group constructing this way it will have this form. So it's a semi-direct product K associated with configuration translations with the abelian group, the dual of V, generating momentum translations. In the case of the sphere, we can take K to be SO3, the moment of configuration translations, and you can take the representation to be the fundamental representation of SO3 on R3. So in that case, certainly we have orbits in the of SO3 inside R3 that are homeomorphic to S2. So you can identify this with the configuration space. The group you get is then SO3 semi-direct product with this the dual of R3. And that is just the Euclidean group in three dimensions. Okay, so now that we have this transitive group of symplectic morphism, we need to realize this as charges on the phase space. The configuration translations, they generate charges that are associated with that can be interpreted as momentum charges. So we call those P. And the momentum translations generate charges that are interpreted as position. So we call those Q. So in this embedding picture, so now S2 is embedded in this abstract vector space R3 as a unit sphere. Then the position charges, you simply be given by taking an element of V dual, a dual element, and acting on the vector X representing the point on the configuration space. So for example, if you take the dual to be E3, then the charge associated to E3 is E3 acting on the vector X, and that will pick the third component of X, and that will correspond to the angle on this cosine theta on the sphere. So we see that it really corresponds to a position labels on the phase space. It labels positions on configuration space. The momentum charges are you simply take the P and act on vectors generated by rotations, the SO3 rotations around a vector n. And so this looks like an angular momentum, but this is modified by our since we modify the symplectic form. This contains a term involving the product between the electric charge and the magnetic charge. Okay, so we can describe the algebra of this. We see that the P they behave like angular momentum, so they represent SO3. The P and Q, they have this non-trivial bracket, so Q is rotated by P, and the Q's commute. And then quantization proceeds as usual by replacing this by commutators in the quantum theory, and we want to find unitary irreducible representations of this algebra. Okay, so let us describe here the representation. It's always convenient to start with the Casimir operators. In this case, we have two independent Casimir operators. One is Q dot Q, and the other is P dot Q. In any complex irreducible representation, the Casimir operators are represented as a multiple of the identity. So we can say that they are some real numbers. So let's say this is called rho square, and this I call S. Okay, now note that the algebra is invariant under rescaling of Q. So we can see here that the first line contains no Q, The second line is linear in Q, so you can just multiply by lambda on both sides. And the third line is a commutative, so you can multiply by lambda square, and therefore you see that the algebra is invariant under rescaling of Q. So without laws of generality, we can take rho to be equal to 1. Okay, and then we can classify the representations very similarly to how it's done in finding representations of SU2 by constructing ladder operators. And we find that, so the states are labeled by the usual J and M labels of the angular momentum algebra, where M is in between minus J and J. And J is belongs to, I mean, J is either integer or half integer. But we see here that depending on S, the minimal J has a minimum, J naught, right? So the states are for all J's above J naught. And J naught is equal to the absolute value of S of this Casimir. And here we note one thing worth mentioning, which is that the only way that S can be equal to J0, which is equal to the minimal value of J, is if S is integer or half integer. Therefore, we see that for any other value of S, there exists no non-trivial unitary representation. So this puts a condition on the possible S's. Okay, but we still have this ambiguity of how to choose between those infinitely countable number of representations by choosing this value of S. So now we want to know what should we do to select the correct or the most natural representation? And here we, Ted and I, we enunciated this principle, the Casimir matching principle. We don't know if this has appeared in other places, but we didn't find it in the context of canonical quantization, at least. And the point is that we should look at the Casimirs of the theory, both quantum mechanically and classically. Classically, we have very analogous Casimirs, so Q dot Q and P dot Q. And they are classical Casimirs in the sense that they Poisson commute with all classical observables. And therefore, they are constant on the phase space. In fact, we can compute them explicitly, and we find that Q dot Q is equal to 1, and P dot Q is equal to minus EG, is equal to minus EG. Okay, now the logic is that both classically and quantum mechanically, the Casimirs take the same value for all states. So if you want to have the classical theory coming as a limit from the quantum theory, we propose this correspondence principle, that is, that the classical and quantum Casimirs shouldn't match. This, therefore, implies that minus EG should be equal to S. And what is interesting is that we just found that there's only non-trivial representations or only non-trivial quantum theories if S is integer or half integer. So then we recover from this purely algebraic perspective the famous Dirac charge discretization condition. Okay, so we can now move to discuss the causal diamonds. So this is a work that was motivated and done in part in collaboration with my advisor, Ted. I have recently published a very large two-part papers on this on archive. And we have two main motivations. One, we want to describe quantum gravity in finite regions, or try to understand how to do that. And the point of view here is that we're going to take the classical notion of finite regions, and by those I mean domains of dependence of finite finite spatial regions, which we call causal diamonds. And then we are going to take this class of objects and quantize those. And the second thing is that we want to do it non-perturbatively and as carefully as possible. In particular, we want to continue the exploration of a program developed by Moncrief in the 90s, based on foliating the space-time by constant mean curvature surfaces. And this has been studied in many situations, most cases without boundaries. And this was recently revived by Witten. And so we want to describe this in this approach. Being more concrete, the system under consideration is 2 plus 1 dimensional Einstein-Hilbert gravity with a non-positive cosmological constant. The space-time is defined to be the domain of dependence of a topological disk. And we choose Dirichlet condition for the metric induced on the boundary of the disk, such that the total boundary length is given by L. Okay, so basically we have here this topological disk. We place here some metric and some conjugated momentum pi, which is related to the extrinsic curvature k. We consider metrics such that when restricted to the boundary, that is equal to some prescribed one-dimensional metric gamma. And if that h and pi satisfy all the constraints of general relativity, then you can take the maximal development of Einstein's equation, and that will define a space-time region, which is a causal diamond. And so here we reiterate that we're not trying to quantize a causal diamond in some fixed background manifold, but rather this class of all possible causal diamonds defined in this way. Okay. So I will quickly review the classical part of the reduction of the phase space. So we want to solve all the constraints and remove the gauge ambiguities at the classical level, and then later just quantize physical degrees of freedom. So we will very briefly review this. These are describing the part one of my paper, which is the classical one. And so I will just enunciate the basic steps that one would like to prove in order to follow Moncrief's program. And so those are things that I proved in this for this class of spacetimes. So one is that you want to show that every diamond can be foliated by CMCs, or so those are surfaces of constant mean curvature, which is where the constant mean curvature is the trace of the extrinsic curvature. And so you want to show that this foliation exists and is well behaved, so with no gaps, no intersections, and so forth. And here is a point where we use the non-positivity of the cosmological constant. More generally, we could include matter as long as they are attracted. So we essentially need some focusing property on geodesics. The second point is that you want to show that the gauge is attainable. So you can put yourself in the CMC gauge via a gauge transformation. But when there are boundaries, one needs to be careful about what happens near the boundary. So if you deform the Cauchy slice in such a way that it changes the angle it makes with the boundary, that may not be a gauge transformation, but rather a symmetry transformation. So implementing a non-trivial flow in the phase space. And here is a point where our condition of fixing the boundary metric was used. But I think we can generalize this drop this condition if we extend the phase space by including edge modes as described by Donnelly, Prado, and others. The third point is that we want to now solve the constraints exactly. And in this gauge, one manner to do that is the Lichanowicz method, in which you take generic data that do not satisfy the constraints, and you do a Weyl transformation, a suitable Weyl transformation until that data satisfy all the constraints of general relativity. And this translates into solving an equation. that is a nonlinear elliptic equation for the Vio factor, the Vio scalar phi. And the main thing here is that we want to prove existence and uniqueness of solutions of this. So we want to ensure that you can always solve the constraints and that there's a unique way to solve the constraints. And this provides a complete characterization of the constraint surface in the phase space, non-perturbative. And here is where we, here's another point we use the non-positivity of cosmological constant. We want this parameter chi appearing in this equation to be non-negative. Okay. And the fourth thing is that then you if all those things can be proven, then you find that the phase space, the reduced phase space, where you're quotient by the gauge transformations, which are now spatial diffeomorphisms, you get a reduced phase space given by the cotangent bundle of the space of conformal geometries on the Cauchy slice, in this case, the disk. The space of conformal geometries is the class of equivalence of metrics quotiented by a Vio scaling and the push forward by a diffeomorphism. Now, the exact form of the bound of the symplectic form needs to be used to say exactly what is the class of conformal transformations that you should quotient by. And using the standard symplectic form, the one is that we get is that we have a, we want to only quotient by conformal transformations that act trivially at the boundary. Okay. Okay. Now you concluded the phase space is the cotangent bundle of the space of conformal geometries, and then you need to classify the space of conformal geometries. In this case, we find that it's a diff S1, diff plus S1 mod PSL2R. So the group of orientation preserving diffeomorphisms of the circle modded by the projective special linear group in two real dimensions. And therefore, the reduced phase space is given by the cotangent bundle of that. Now, a lot of those steps can be in principle generalized to higher dimensions and things with matter, as I mentioned. But then, and you still find something very similar to this. I mean, something similar to the phase space being the cotangent bundle of the space of conformal geometries. But then you would have the difficult mathematical problem of classifying the space of conformal geometries on higher dimensional manifolds. So here we decide to do 2+1 dimension so that we have a very concrete characterization of that and can have a better handle of the problem. Okay, so the interpretation of that, we got an infinite dimensional reduced phase space, but we also know that in 2+1 dimensions, there are no local degrees of freedom. So what are all those states? Well, since locally, our spacetimes must be isometric to a little piece of ADS3 or Minkowski if the cosmological constant is zero. And the topology of our Cauchy surface is the topology of a disk. This means that every classical state that we have, every causal diamond, can be actually embedded as a causal diamond in ADS3 or Minkowski. So all the states that we have are all the different shapes of those diamonds in ADS3. In addition, we can note that if you just specify the shape of the corner of the diamond, so this loop that is the boundary of the Cauchy slice, this is sufficient to determine the shape of the whole causal diamond. Right, so you can take any like a spatial surface filling this loop and then compute the domain of dependence of that disk. Therefore, we can think of the phase space as the space of loops with fixed length because of our boundary condition that can be embedded into ADS3 or Minkowski for zero cosmological constant as the boundary of a space-like disk. So this is the classical part. Now we have this nonlinear phase space, and you want to quantize it according to Isham's method. So this is what is the part two of my paper is about, implementing this quantization. And I will quickly explain here. So very analogously to what we did with the sphere, we can note that the configuration space is a homogeneous space for diff plus S1. And so it's natural to start with an action of diff S1 on this configuration space. And as before, this has a natural lift to the cotangent bundle, so to the phase space. And that action on the phase space is a simplex homomorphism. But again, it's not transitive. We need to enlarge the group with vertical translations. However, if we try to apply the similar algorithm that we did for the particle on the sphere, here we have a trouble because we could not find any representation of this group diff S1 that had an orbit isomorphic to the configuration space Q. Luckily, it's known that the coadjoint representation of the Virasoro group, which is a central extension of the diff S1 by a central direction R, on its dually algebra Vira star, it does have an orbit that is isomorphic to our configuration space, diff S1 mod PSL. And since the Virasoro is just a central extension of the of diff S1, it also has a very natural action on the configuration space, where the diff part of Virasoro acts just as before, but the central element acts trivially on the phase space. And so we can take the group of configuration translations to be Virasoro and construct the momentum translations from the embedding of Q into the dual of Virasoro, the Virasoro algebra. And then we get this canonical group, which so it's Virasoro, and here's the double dual of Virasoro. Now, we will assume that the double dual of the Virasoro algebra is isomorphic to itself. But it's interesting to keep in mind the possibility of distributional momentum translations. Okay, so let's describe the algebra of this. The elements of the Virasoro algebra are characterized by a vector field on the circle, together with a central component X. In a natural Fourier basis, we're expanding Fourier the vector fields on the circle. You get those components. So here, L and R are associated to the configuration translations, and so the Virasoro group part of the group, and K and T are the associated to the momentum translations. So it's associated to the Virasoro algebra part of the group. And R and T are central elements. So if you write down the algebra of our group, we have that the L's and R, they form the usual Virasoro algebra. The K's, they commute because the momentum translations commute. And we have a non-trivial product between K and L. Okay. Now we need to realize, hey.
Hi, can you hear me? You have just to remind you, you have more or less 5 minutes left.
More or less 5 minutes?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So let me speed up a little bit. So you want to realize this on the phase space. And so the L's correspond to configuration translations, and then they generate momentum charges. In the case, generate momentum translations, so they generate position charges. And the R and T are realized as the constant function zero. Sorry, R is realized as the constant function zero and T as the constant function one. And then you can write down the Poisson algebra, and we find you find that the algebra of momenta now reduce back to the diffeomorphism in algebra, the algebra of Q's commute, and the Q's and P, they have this bracket with a central element. And it's interesting that this corresponds to the BMS3 algebra. Okay, the quantization follows by finding unitary irreducible projective representations of the canonical group. And since the canonical group is the semi-direct product of a group with an abelian factor, we can apply Mackey's theory of induced representation, modulo possibly issues with the infinite dimensionality. This was studied by Oblak not so long ago in the context of BMS. And the result of Mackey's theory is that the representation is given by wave functions, psi, that are sections of a vector bundle whose base space is some quadrant orbit O of Virasoro, and the fibers carry some projective unitary irreducible representation of the corresponding little group. So H is the subgroup of Virasoro that fixes that particular quadrant orbit. Okay, but then we have a lot of representations. In particular, there are many possible quadrant orbits to choose. So now we want to use our Casimir matching principle to refine that. Elements of the dual of Virasoro are characterized by very similar to Virasoro, but now they are characterized by a quadratic form on the S1 on the circle, together with a central component A. The simplest Casimirs are the T and R themselves. And classically, we have seen the T was equal to 1. And this essentially implies that the central component of the orbit is 1. And R equal to 0 implies that the central R inside the little group H is represented trivially. Note that the central element of Virasoro always acts trivially under the quadrant action. So there's always a central R inside any little group for any quadrant orbit. So what I'm saying is that that R is represented trivially by the Casimir matching principle. And here I have something that I propose those generalized Casimirs, which are Casimirs that are not real valued, but they are valued in some nonlinear manifold, and so I'm proposing to extend the Casimir matching principle to those more general Casimirs, and in this case we have essentially two of those. One is this SL2R conjugacy classes of the monodromy matrix. Let me very briefly explain what that is. That is defined from the Hill's operator, which is something inside the theory of Virasoro, the Virasoro group. And basically, we know that we can associate to any element of the dual of Virasoro algebra, so any alpha tilde, we can associate to that quadratic differential operator. So recall here that alpha tilde contains one function alpha and a number a. And so you use those to construct this differential operator. And they act on densities of weight minus 1/2. Given a basis of two normalized solutions, so by solutions I mean the kernel of these operators, so things that functions where these apply to those f's vanish. So if you take two of those, we have only two because it's a quadratic operator, then the monodromy matrix tells you how this base F1, F2 rotates as you go around a 2 pi rotation around this one. And so M is like a 2x2 matrix belonging to SL. If you had chosen another basis, another F1 and F2 to define this M, then you define M that is conjugated by SL to R. So the only basis independent quantity associated to alpha tilde in this way is the SL conjugacy class of the monodromy matrix. And what is interesting is that you can show that the conjugacy class M is constant along any quadjoint orbit of Virasoro. And therefore, we can actually construct an operator that is a Casimir, but is generalized in the sense that it's valued in the space of conjugacy classes. It's not valued in a vector space. We have also another winding number. Okay, this is the last slide. Classically, you can show that this Casimir is the SL conjugacy class of the minus identity. And this implies that the orbits are diff S1 mod PSL N 2R, where N is an odd natural number, where this PSL N is the N-fold cover of PSL 2R. Using this other Casimir that I didn't explain, which is the winding number, it's a natural number. For the classical, evaluating classically, it gives 1, and this implies that N equal 1. So it means that it's just the one-fold cover of PSL, and therefore it's just PSL itself. So we conclude that the natural orbit from the Casimir matching principle is just the configuration space. And therefore the Hilbert space will be given by wave functions on the configuration space with indices in a projective unitary irreducible representation of SL2R. So in other words, so basically the conclusion is that the quantum configuration space, which is the space where the wave functions live, is the same as the classical configuration space. Now, perhaps it would be more dramatic if I said that I found a very different quantum configuration space, but the point here is that I had no a priori assumptions about the Hilbert space. And from this principle, I proved that this is the most natural representation in this case. Okay. Can I have more 3 minutes?
Let's say two.
Two, okay. Okay. So I would just mention one interesting operator, which is the spin. It can be interpreted as the twist of the boundary loop, where the twist is essentially a measure of the holonomy of the normal bundle around this loop. Classically, it's a continuum parameter. But from the quantum mechanics, we can show that it's the twist is discretized. It has a discrete spectrum in terms of integer or half integer multiples of this ratio involving the Planck length to the loop length. And so it's interesting to note that if you take a loop very large compared to the Planck length, then the step in this discretization gets very small, and then you recover the classical continuum twist. Okay, that is the conclusion. So I try to argue here that we should be careful about canonical quantization, especially in the context of gravity, that complex valued wave functions on the configuration space should not be taken for granted. And additional principles are necessary to select preferred representation, since generally you don't have uniqueness. In particular, I propose this this Casimir matching principle. We studied the quantization of causal diamonds in tuples on gravity, fully non-perturbatively, implementing Moncrief's program at the classical level, and using Isham's method to quantize it. And so a few like general questions is, we still don't have a good understanding of the quantum nature of those causal diamonds, the nature of the space-time. A proposal here is this twist quantization, can it be promoted to a general statement about loops in ADS3? And also note that the discretization condition was found to be independent of the cosmological constant. So one may conjecture that this is independent of the matter content. It would be nice to generalize, of course, with matter and then possibly with two higher dimensions. And in particular, drop the. I also want to construct the. To see whether it's possible to construct a whole quantum spacetime by gluing causal diamonds. For this purpose, I think it would be necessary to drop the boundary condition on the metric and introduce edge modes. And of course, the famous questions in thermodynamics and entanglement. Counting entropy depends, in principle, may depend on the precise nature of the spectrum of operators. So that is one point where this global and careful quantization may affect. It may affect the spectrum of operators. So it would be interesting to see what one gets here. All right. Thank you very much.
A lot, Rodrigo. There is already a question by Bianca, so we can start there.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Apparently, I have to speak to Zoom.
To the sky.
To the sky. Thanks for this very beautiful talk. I have a number of questions, but I think I will restrict to a few. So you showed that you get a BMS. Mm-hmm. As a group of as a group on the space base, sorry. But you can also for negative cosmological constant. So is it that you get BMS because you consider a finite region in EDS, and so then it's not a conformity?
Yes. I think the main difference from EDS and Minkowski is at the global level, right? The conformal structure, the infinity. But since we're just considering like finite regions, like locally, you cannot just have such a difference in the group. So in fact, if you look at the causal diamonds, it kind of look more like the conformal structure of Minkowski. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Uh-huh.
And the second is possibly more, well, it's a question remark. So your winding number or your winding, it reminds me of the winding where we found in this holography papers with Aldo Rello and Tra Levine and Christoph Göller. So indeed, in our case, we considered the torus and kind of also just needed to quantize the boundary of the torus. But then the quantum theory allowed arbitrary number of windings of the torus surface around itself. So uh-huh. could you possibly also allow a non-vanishing winding number, a non-trivial winding number n, and in your quantization?
Yeah. So in principle, yes. I mean, if you believe the Casimir matching principle. Which the only reason I have to believe that is that it recovered that nice Dirac quantization in the case of the particle in this sphere. So uh-huh. It seems that there may be something fundamental there. So if you believe, oh, but there's another thing. So this is a generalized Casimir principle. It's not the standard. It's not the standard Casimir principle. So you may worry that it doesn't work. I mean, you should. Right. So the winding number is a natural number. It's not a real uh-huh. number. So, so the status of this is up to debate.
Yeah.
The only point is that if you believe the generalized Casimir principle, then this is the only possibility.
Uh-huh. And I think I have one last question now. For ADS, using John Simons. I think there was a recent paper by Kotler and Jensen, and possibly also before by Witten and Maloney. And they find something like a reduced phase space, which looks similar. And I think it's diff S1 or diff plus S1, but then it's modulo SL2Z, no? I don't remember what the relation is between this quantization of EDS, which usually is asymptotically.
The group, the phase space that they find is very similar indeed. In fact, it's exactly the same in one sense. So we find here the cotangent bound of this space, and the most natural space when you reduce for ADS is dfs1 mod PSL times itself. So it's like q times q instead of t star of q. Now, there is a very interesting but non-trivial simple ectomorphism that was shown by Krasnov and another person that I forgot, that those two, there is a non-trivial simple ectomorphism. But so at least classically, there is this identification. But at the quantization level, the two quantizations are different because the quantization depends on the form that you're presented with your phase space. If you had Q times Q, the most natural quantization would be to take two copies of Virasoro acting on each Q. And that gives the usual CFT, the two copies of Virasoro. In our case, we had one Virasoro with one abelian group.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
There is another question by Josh, please.
Just wondering about the Casimir matching principle. Is it just, should I just think of that as consistency of the classical limit, or is it more strong than that? Is it a stronger statement?
The logic that I like to think about how to justify this is from the correspondence principle, because at both levels, so classically, Casimir commutes with every Poisson commutes with every observable, so it's constant on the phase space. And quantum mechanically, the Casimir commutes with every operator in the representation, and by the Schur's lemma, it must be represented as a multiple of the identity. So it's also, so it's constant. It takes the same value on every state, in both class, in the classical theory and the quantum theory. So it seems most natural that in the correspondence principle, you shouldn't match those the value of the Casimirs.
There is a question on Zoom. Paul, if you can please unmute yourself.
Thank you. Thank you, Rodrigo. Very nice talk. I had two questions for you. One was about the monodromy, in which case I would have expected, you know, to have a monodromy, you have to have a singularity somewhere on the interior. And I didn't catch what singularity that might be in this case.
Yeah, so in this case, you can have non-trivial monodromy even without singularity. Because, so what happens is that we are looking for solutions of this operator. And this operator, it has alpha is a function on S1, so it has a 2 pi translation symmetry. But the solutions to this equation, so the kernel of this, they are not necessarily periodic on the circle. So you should think of these solutions as functions on the universal cover of S1. And so what happens is that when you translate the solutions by 2 pi, they don't get back, because they not necessarily get back to the same value, but you just like rotate on the space of solutions. So f of 2 plus theta is a linear combination of the original the solutions at theta. And so the monodromy matrix is capturing this the non-periodicity of solutions of this equation.
But are you sure that doesn't correspond to some sort of singularity in the disk if you were to somehow view that solution as boundary values for a solution in the disk?
Yeah.
The question is, it seems like that would be interesting. It seems like that singularity would be something interesting.
That's a good point. I never thought of trying to extend the solutions to the interior.
If I can comment, in our case, you could interpret these winding numbers. If you had a winding number n equal to 1, it corresponded to a Planck mass particle at the center. So that induces kind of a deficit angle of 2 pi, if you want.
I see.
In 3D gravity, that's exactly what I would expect. Particles are somehow conical defects, and you might expect that this corresponds to that singularity.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, it may be that so if we introduce, yeah, that would be an interesting thing to do. Like if we introduce a conical deficit and apply this quantization, maybe now the Casimir principle in that case will tell us to pick another monodromy class. Or I mean, sorry, or another winding number. That is a good, interesting observation.
My other question was about you tried to indicate, and maybe you can't say more quickly, but where the negative cosmological constant is coming into the story. So I understood that in order to guarantee that you have these constant mean curvature slices, you need that. But do you really think that's essential, or it's just a mathematical issue of characterizing the slicings?
Yeah, well, at the, so at this point is it's a mathematical requirement in order to have to be able to prove that this gauge exists in all solutions. And essentially what you need, you need focusing of geodesics basically. And so and the main problem is actually on the only on the maximal slice. So whether there's a gap or not in the maximal slice. It could be that if you have a, but this would be not, would be approximate, but if you have like a positive cosmological constant, but you also have matter that are that behave attractively, then maybe you can carry this approximately in the regime where the diamond is small enough so that the cosmological constant doesn't have enough strength to diverge the geodesics. So maybe in this approximate sense, you can extend to positive cosmological constant.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah,
Right.
Thank you.
There is another Zoom question by an M87 black hole. So Laurent, if you can unmute yourself and ask the question. Thank you.
Hello, Rodrigo. Thank you for this very, very clear talk. I have a couple of questions. Maybe one follows Al's question. Your construction really relies a lot on using this particular slicing inside the diamond. On the other hand, the whole philosophy is about, trying to quantize the causal diamond. And then you find that the group you're having is kind of a corner group, right? So in some sense, how much of your construction really depends on choosing this particular slicing inside? I can imagine other way to slice the diamond, and will I get a different quantization, which would or not? I mean, that's the first question.
Yeah, that is interesting. So the point is, so this it's very hard to find a universal manner to solve the constraints in gravity, right? Both to actually solve all the constraints, including the Hamiltonian one, and second, to remove all the gauge ambiguities. So this is one of the only programs that I know in which, in a very large class of spacetimes, you can show this universal, this yeah, this universal existence of a gauge fixing followed by in principle full solution of the constraints. And this conclusion here that Q is the space of conformal geometries of the Cauchy slice is very general. It's not applied, it's not special to this case. So as long as we are quantizing a class of spacetimes in which we can prove each of those steps, we will get to this point.
Would you agree that this configuration space should not depend in the end of your choice of gauge inside, or does it depend? It should not, right? You agree with that?
Yeah, I agree. It should not. Yes.
Okay. Okay. A second question is more on the outlook. So you mentioned. Maybe a clarification. You kind of mentioned at some point you had a quantization of length. Can you show back this formula?
A quantization of
you
twist?
Quantization in terms of the length, the boundary length.
I didn't have quantization of the length. I had of the twist.
No, but you had the 1 over L in unit of the length. Yeah.
Oh, okay. This R, yeah.
Yeah. Here the parametric length that you put on the boundary enters. So if you try to put all these different causal diamonds and together with different lengths, what does it mean in terms of the, you know, does that mean that you have a quantization of geometry, or that's, how do you interpret this kind of twist formula there? Because here L is just a scalar that you can freely choose, but ultimately in the theory of quantum gravity, it's going to be another operator.
Yeah, that's true. So in this case, L is indeed just a real parameter. And the discretization of the geometry in this case comes in the twist, since the twist classically is a continuum, and it measures something very geometrical about the loop. And in this case, we found this, it's discrete. So certainly there's something discrete about geometry, but not the length. So there was in particular no Casimir matching principle, for example, to restrict the possibilities of values of L. Now, I think it would be very interesting to relax this condition on the boundary length. The problem is that the difficulty is that the is not well. The thing is that then you cannot implement the Moncrief's program exactly as I did, because then you cannot put yourself into the CMC gauge. But it would be very interesting to extend the phase space by edge modes in a way that to reintroduce the possibility of gauge transformations that change the angle that the Cauchy slice makes with the boundary.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then, yeah, because, yeah, so, yeah, the point is, ultimately, I would like the length operator to be an operator, not a real parameter.
Mm-hmm. Okay, maybe I have a last question, which is, can you say more? So here you look at one causal diamond with fixed boundary metrics. So how do you envision somehow, you know, gluing this? I mean, I'm thinking, you know, it looks like you're thinking of this causal diamond as some kind of a building block of quantum space-time, right? So how are you planning to, what do you envision of using it as a building block and gluing space times and constructing bigger objects?
Yeah. So, very
open question.
No. Yeah. So, yeah. So, the perspective that I took here, like that I actually took here, was to think of the causal diamonds as self-contained objects. So they are not living anywhere. I'm just quantizing that class of floating objects. And we did get this interpretation of embedding into ADS3, but that is a consequence of the fact that there's no local degrees of freedom, but we didn't assume this a priori. Now, to glue those things, the quantum objects, to form a larger Hilbert space, sorry, a larger space-time, which would be very nice to do. I don't see how to do it with the current boundary condition. It seems that we need to allow the fluctuation of the metric when you glue two things together. And so in that sense is where I think we need to enlarge the phase space by edge modes, and then do the full quantization on the bulk, and also glue the edges using the with the edge modes. I mean, this would be. I would think of this like doing this in 2+1 as an exercise to do it in 3+1, because in 3+1 the edge modes they only describe what happens at the boundary itself, but we still have bulk degrees of freedom, right? And so ultimately we would want to describe both things at the together, right? Both the bulk things and the edge things into a single consistent thing. And in principle this program can be extended to 3+1. But then there's the mathematical problem of classifying conformal geometries on a three-dimensional manifold.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Maybe if I can add just one comment before going to the concert. Just one comment on that is that maybe even in 2+1, there is something that in order to glue, that one should, I mean, essentially in the language we've been using in the past, it looks to me that you're choosing the embedding of the circle that describes the boundary of your causal diamond. And by gluing together, one will need to sum over different possible embeddings, and that will give you a condition for gluing together two of these regions. But just as a personal take on how to go a step further. But I agree with what you said before, that eventually we'll need to relax the boundary condition that you're putting. That's mm-hmm. I agree with that. Yeah. Okay, so other questions? I don't see. I think we had a lot of questions for Rodrigo, so let's thank Rodrigo again.
Yeah, thank you very much for the invitation.